Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 232 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Eleanor Dimet explains how an encounter with the tangible aspects of photography during deeply immersive research for her second novel almost stopped her being a novelist. Then Alex Martin considers whether it's better to be a man of action or to live a more contemplative life. Or can a writer do both? First, here's Eleanor Dimet with One Thing at a Time.
I'd make him a writer, I decided. He would live by the sea, somewhere warm. On an island, perhaps. His daughters would return to his sea-bound home after his death. The story of their lives would emerge in pieces, shot through with their memories of this man they'd loved and hated. A week into my new book, I changed my mind. How could I have thought that writing about writing was a good idea? The difficulties of producing a second novel are well known, and I decided on this question of my anti-hero's profession to give myself a break. I knew he had to be a creative artist of some kind, though. Searching for another medium, I considered and set aside painting, then sculpting, then music. At a loss, I thought through my half-formed ideas for the novel again. I wanted my tale to be about light and shadow and things reflected on water, about swimming and immersion and the way images and character echo across the generations of a family. Mine would be a story of likenesses, of rebirths, of imprints, and the development of a child's identity within a family unit. It was as plain as day. My man would have to be a photographer, and one of the old school. There was a hitch. Beyond a passing familiarity with that Robert Duano kiss, which had been plastered on the walls of my boarding school dormitories, I hadn't the slightest shred of knowledge about darkroom photography. What I did have, though, was time, access to a very good library, and a ready supply of friends with varying degrees of expertise in the field. I steered clear of all the novels already out there about photographers, and instead turned to books about the history and the idea of photography. Susan Sontag and John Berger were two of my guides, and Mary Warner Marion's Photography, A Cultural History, my doorstopper bedfellow. I paced the halls of every exhibition I could find. In New York, I lingered at MoMA and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. In London, both Tate's again and again, the National Portrait Gallery and the Science Museum. When a return visit to New York threw up Harry Callahan, I was hooked on his every shot. Here, in repeated images of his wife, Eleanor, and their tiny daughter, Barbara, I had the beginnings of a narrative, a shutter closing on a family. Always different, always the same, Callahan's works together formed a graphic novel. The plot was simple, a love affair, which turned into a marriage, and then a family. I found his pictures of his wife's body, distant and close, naked and clothed, beautiful, but at the same time thought the line they trod between the intimate and the intrusive to be a fine one, and sometimes disturbingly so. What had it been like for Eleanor, I wondered, to wake and find his lens above her face, or to see it almost touching her pregnant belly? On my last visit to the Met before flying home, I happened by chance on a large-scale photograph of a man in Edwardian dress, his arms folded lightly on his chest, his forehead pierced by a bullet hole. I had no idea how exactly, but I knew that that image would find its way into my story. Edward Steichen's work also features heavily in my memory of that second trip. At home again, I had looked online and found his Woodbury soap ad. His shot of a naked woman, reaching over her own back to wash herself, nudged my novel forward. Pieces of the jigsaw were falling into place. By the close of those preliminary stages of looking and reading, I'd become sure of the mood I wanted to create, and had acquired an understanding of the history of photography from its beginnings. So far, so good. I had a title, Silver and Salt, and a name for my photographer, Max Hollingbourne. But I realised that if I wanted to write about Max's craft, I'd have to go several steps further. I'd have to open the door to his darkroom and find out how it was done. I approached an old friend, Florence Dollet, who had worked as a professional darkroom photographer. I asked to become her apprentice and bought a 3-month membership of a shared darkroom near her home in East London. Florence took me to specialist shops and we stocked up on supplies. I made notes about everything she bought, everything she rejected, and everything she said. When she explained how she worked in her own darkroom, I drew diagrams and committed her rules to memory. She gave me a reading list. Rather than Berger and Sontag, the authors were practitioners and the books manuals, not monographs. I'd known Florence for several years, and though I'd seen her exhibitions and bought some of her work, I'd never witnessed her making it. We agreed the following terms. The darkroom I'd rented for the 3 months would be hers to use at all times of the day and night. I could visit when I wanted, taking notes and asking questions. Finally, one May afternoon, we were in. My writer's budget meant I'd had to scour the market for an affordable workspace, tucked away in premises near Bethnal Green, belonging to an artist's collective. The one I'd found could at best be described as idiosyncratic and at worst, life-threatening. It had formerly been a bathroom, and a small one at that. Crouched on an upturned box by a bathtub, over which a drop-down panel made from an old door acted as a shelf for the developing trays, I watched, enthralled. The light became red and ghostly images emerged as if from nowhere. I covered the pages of my notebook, becoming ever more beholden to this sorcerer decoding the mysteries of her art. Partway through my apprenticeship, an incident took place which nearly derailed not just Silver and Salt, but any kind of writing at all, ever again. It was a few weeks in, after a stint when I'd been visiting every day and making notes on the progress of a particular series of prints. To my surprise, Florence beckoned me over to the enlarger. I watched her load up a negative. She told me to put down my notebook and pencil, then she asked me to place my hands on the enlarger's dials. Silencing my protestations, "I don't know how to do it, I'll get it wrong, I'll waste your precious photographic paper, bought at great expense, I'm here to take notes, not to develop prints," she flicked the switch. What happened next was one of the most striking experiences of my life. As the process began and my hands moved on the dials, I felt as though I was standing at the helm of a ship. We were making a test strip. I moved the paper over and again, counting out the seconds. An actual shiver passed up my spine, and a kind of current rushed down my arms and through my fingertips. These short-term effects were startling. All my writing life, it seemed, I had been only an observer. I'd taken events I'd witnessed or imagined, then rearranged them into stories. I'd devoted myself to the art of making things up. Now, though, I was creating something tangible. Over the hours that followed, under Florence's tutelage, I developed contact sheets and test strips. Making as many mistakes as I made prints, I apologised and said I was ready to stop. Florence insisted I continue, though. Mistakes were part of the process. Without them, nothing would be learned. I did what she told me to do, excited and inspired. That evening, as I packed up and left, I decided to tackle a new scene as soon as possible. I walked home with an awareness that something significant had occurred. By accepting Florence's invitation to participate, rather than watch, I had allowed her to shift my perspective. What I hadn't bargained for, though, was what would happen the next day when, back in my study, I sat down to write a new chapter. Initially, I had no idea anything was wrong. I began my work as I usually did. Sharpening 5 pencils, I flicked through my transcriptions book and read a few perfect sentences by writers I admired. I watched Prince sing Alphabet Street on YouTube. Then I set my timer for my writing session and focused. Nothing came. This was a new situation for me. It was, in fact, the first time it had ever happened. I stared into space, disbelieving, and willed an opening line to come. Still nothing. It was then that I understood. In that moment of transition the previous day, when Florence had handed me the controls and said, "Now you do it," something else had happened, something much deeper than I'd realised. by altering my role from writer to photographer, and by removing myself from the realm of theory and placing myself, instead, firmly in the actual, I had stopped being a novelist. The writer's block lasted only a few days, but the episode had been alarming. It's a well-documented thing, the position of writer as passive observer, writer as outsider, writer as onlooker. The work of a darkroom photographer, on the other hand, certainly of the sort done by my Max Hollingborn, war photographer-turned-society portraitist, is physically immersive, in a way that writing never is. There are parallels, though. A photographer is by definition always watching, or rather always looking on. In the sort of single-scene short fiction I sometimes write, I will take a close-up and use a film with a much higher speed than one I'd used for a novel. And with those larger-scale narratives, it's long exposures all the way, so that things sometimes emerge in the final print I'd had no idea would be there when I began. When I'm writing, I can take my time. Of course, there are days when ideas come quickly and I capture them immediately. When I started out, that seemed to be the only way to work. I had to seize the image and note the scene or risk losing it forever. Now, years on, I've learned not to panic write. Once I've seen something remarkable or heard a conversation that's made an impression, I can rely on the fact that when I later want to recall it, all I have to do is close my eyes and think back. By hitting rewind, then play, on my memory, I can watch the events unfold again. Did I think about switching medium in that week of non-writing that followed my spell at the Enlarger? I'd be lying if I said I hadn't, for one moment, thought of laying down my pencils and taking up photography. It was nothing more than a fleeting thought, though, gone as soon as it had come. My darkroom tutor had honed her craft since childhood. I'd been writing stories, I realised, for as long as she'd been making photographs. Like her, I'd become so absorbed in my chosen medium, I'd never let it go. Now, if I reflect on what happened that week, I think of it as a kind of an excitement overload. My writer's mind, being unable to sustain the dual roles of observer and actor, had simply short-circuited. Preparing this talk, I came across a fragment I'd transcribed into my research notebook. Marc-Antoine Gaudin, a maker of optical instruments, writing almost 200 years ago, expresses better than I can myself the intensity of what I felt. I'll finish with his words rather than my own. Speaking of the excitement following the first public demonstration of Daguerre's image-making process at the joint meeting of the Academy of Science and the Academy of Fine Art in Paris on August 19th, 1839, he said this: "We all felt an extraordinary emotion and unknown sensations. Everyone wanted to copy the view offered by his window, and very happy was he who had first obtained a silhouette of roofs against the sky. He was in ecstasies over the stovepipes. He did not cease to count the tiles on the roofs and the bricks of the chimneys. He was astonished to see the cement between each brick. In a word, the porous picture caused him unutterable joy, inasmuch as the process was then new and appeared deservedly marvellous."
That was Eleanor Dimet, recorded by herself. You can find out more about Eleanor on her website at eleanordimet.com. That's Eleanor, spelt E-L-A-N-O-R, and Dimet, spelt D-Y-M-O-T-T. Next, here's Alex Martin with Writing versus Life.
Although I'm a generally happy and positive person, there is one contradiction in my life that really troubles me. Two opposing impulses pull me simultaneously in different directions, one towards a life of action, the other towards a more contemplative life of writing. I've written 30 books, 27 of them published, so yes, I'm a writer. But I'm also a frustrated man of action. By that I don't mean I have James Bond fantasies. I just love doing things. Cooking, walking, practicing Tai Chi, gardening, rowing, singing in a choir, scuba diving, planning expeditions to new places. In particular, I love doing things out of doors. A day spent in the open air is an extra day added to your life, or so I believe. I don't get enough time to do any of those physically active things as well as I would like, but they all bring me a great deal of joy and satisfaction. On the other hand, I write for several hours each day, and at the end of most days I get up from my desk feeling dissatisfied. Sometimes with the quality of what I've produced, sometimes the quantity, often both. Writing comes to me easily, but good writing always at a cost. It takes me many revisions and a lot of time and hard thinking to produce a few sentences that I'm genuinely pleased with. Sentences that seem effortless and natural, waste no words, and paint a vivid picture in the reader's mind. That really is difficult, and it never gets any easier. I often ask myself, is it worth all this trouble? Am I enjoying this? And sometimes I have to be honest with myself and say, no, this is no fun at all, and it's not going anywhere. Other days, of course, there's a marvellous feeling of completeness and achievement, especially when I finish a chapter or sign off a book or get an enthusiastic review. But for every satisfying day, there must be 10 or 20 that are marked by frustration. The biographer Michael Holroyd put this nicely when he said he often has difficult weeks, but they pay off in the end. If you work hard Monday to Thursday, no matter how bad those days are, you'll always have a good Friday. So, I'm a writer and a frustrated man of action. But I'm not complaining. On the whole, I prefer this arrangement to its reverse, a man of action and a frustrated writer. Ideally, there must be a balance, but in my experience, it's extremely rare to find it. Life is a short blanket, as Randall Jarrell said. You can cover your shoulders or your feet, but not both. When our children were young, this was less of a problem. For a few years I practically stopped writing, apart from an occasional diary entry or sketch for a story. This was a painful but quick decision, and I never regretted it. We had twin boys, and the first 5 years of their lives were totally demanding. It felt as if we were running a restaurant, hospital, nursery school and lunatic asylum all at the same time. I had a job as a university lecturer, which I somehow managed to carry on doing with very little sleep and a lot of improvisation. But my wife was having a very hard time with all the work involved in keeping those two little fellows clean, nourished and safe. I wanted to do my share. I'm convinced this was right, as it seemed to me essential to the happiness of my family. It strikes me as an act of great cruelty and folly to bring a child into the world and then ignore it. Children thrive on love and attention. There's no adequate substitute. Those years of excitement have long passed, and I look back on them with joy. The boys are now men, and I have much more freedom to choose how I spend my time. But that old tension has returned. Is it to be a life of writing or a life of action? Or can I find that elusive equilibrium between the two? Talking to other writers, I realise that many of them, the ones I think of as writers by nature, don't see it quite the way I do. They're completely happy with a life of writing. In most cases, they've had to slog away at a day job for years, and once they reach the very privileged position of writing for a living, they certainly are not going to complain about it, or give up and go back to the old 9 to 5. I've had day jobs too, as I mentioned. As well as a teacher, I've been a gardener, care assistant in an old people's home, an editor, a radio presenter, an odd job man, even the director of a waterways festival. That was fun. And we had a nice festival. But it took a year out of my life, and I still remember it with a pang. Those sleepless nights, the phone calls, the battles with officials, the meetings, the to-do lists, the exhaustion. So I don't miss that, and I hope I never have to do it again. But there's something about the commitment of a life of action, the adrenaline rush of split-second decisions, the wonderful satisfaction of making something happen that I miss as I sit at my desk, thinking, writing, getting frustrated. I'd like to get to the root of this tension. I think it goes back to my own childhood and upbringing, which of course had a profound effect on me, shaped me as a person, and influenced my thinking and values in powerful, subconscious ways. I was brought up in Kent, in a house with a big garden where we kept chickens, a dog, a tortoise, a pond full of goldfish, and several cats. One of the cats was given the name Lucky. He had walked in through our back door one night during an almighty thunderstorm, and given a warm welcome by us, decided to stay. All the cats were mesmerized by the goldfish, but could never figure out how to catch them. It was a menagerie of a home, and very happy. My father was a marine engineer. He had served in the Royal Artillery during the war, in North Africa, Sicily, and Normandy, and chased the enemy all the way back to Germany, where he had helped to liberate a concentration camp. He was a thoughtful man. Like all who fought in the war, he saw terrible things, maybe even did some, but he never let the dark side of human life affect him. He had decided to be a problem solver, and his training as an engineer suited him well for this task. He was a dynamic man, with unstoppable energy, great kindness and humour. He travelled to an office in London most days, but was often called away in the middle of the night or at weekends to fix ships that had broken down in places like Antwerp and Rotterdam. My mother was anchored to the home with five children. She too had immense energy and a restless, inquiring mind. She combined curiosity, intelligence, and compassion in a way that I still think of as ideal for a thinking person. She was trained as a doctor and worked part-time, fitting in surgeries and research around the needs of the family. She was also Greek and regarded hospitality as one of the sacred duties of her life. Our wider family included some go-getters too. There was Uncle Jim, a fighter pilot from Edinburgh, complete with handlebar moustache and tales of his escape from the jaws of death in a Martin Baker ejector seat. There were Aunt Em and Uncle Ken, who lived in Ghana, and a series of globe-trotting Greek uncles who frequently called in to see us on their travels. Our house was cosmopolitan as well as multi-species. Uncle Eugene was an extraordinary character. He had served in the British and Greek navies during the war, first on destroyers, then as a commando on fishing boats in the Mediterranean. He returned home to Athens in December 1944 to find a civil war raging. As soon as he could, he emigrated to America, disgusted by the deadly political chaos in Greece. Eugene was an engineer like my father and made a fortune in shipping. He would drop in for the night on his way from Athens to New York or Oslo to Cape Town, always wearing a beautifully cut suit, handing out pound notes and useful advice to his nephews and nieces. His conversation was a wild mix of big game hunting and ancient Greek history. Herodotus and Thucydides were his bedtime reading. One day we learned that Eugene had designed two high-speed gunboats to defend the islands of the eastern Aegean. Then he'd built them and given them to the Greek navy. They made him an honorary admiral for that. A while later we heard that he had financed the building of an archaeological museum at Marathon. The museum is still there, with his name on a brass plate in the entrance. He was a man of action, all right. Difficult to live with, but admirable in many ways. These people were my role models, exceptionally dynamic characters, driven by an explosive energy that I witnessed and admired, absorbing it as a norm in my most impressionable years. They all respected the life of the intellect. They were keen and curious readers. But for all of them, action came first, then contemplation. As it happens, all of them tried writing at one time or another. My Uncle Eugene put together a family history, which is not an easy read. My father wrote good letters, but could never manage anything more formal, even though he wanted to. My mother wrote three lovely little books, which she called Stories from My Life. They're not great literature, just simple accounts of her youth in Greece and her later years as a mother and doctor in England. They preserve the important moments of her life for successive generations to learn from and enjoy. So where does this leave me? Still in a state of tension. But as I write these words and reflect on what I'm doing, paying tribute to the people I have loved, keeping thoughts and memories alive, I find a special satisfaction. This is, in fact, action of a particularly valuable kind.
That was Alex Martin, recorded by Carol Angier. You can find out more about Alex on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 232, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 233, Doug Johnston speaks with Cherise Saywell about shifting from engineering to domestic noir via music journalism, exploring conflicted masculinity in his work, and being part of the tartan noir family of Scottish crime writers. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.